Remember how to get to these lessons now if you need to. GraceBibleChurch.org. All one word. And there's lessons there. There's links there when you get to that homepage to this lesson and others as well. Other Sunday school teachers are there as well. So you can, I think we put 150 hours of new lessons out there last year. So there's a bunch of lessons out there for you if you care to partake of them. Okay, we're working our way through the book of Daniel. And our overall study that we're doing is a review of eschatology. Remember what that word means, eschatology? Well, the ology part is just the study of. But the eska has to do with end things, end times. It can be, a focus can be on people. It can be on nations. It can be on events. But end things. And so we're going to survey the book of Daniel. We'll look at the book of Revelation. We'll look at some chapters in Ezekiel. We'll look at Matthew 24 and 25. And maybe another passage or two here or there as well to try to identify end time events and peoples and nations. And so that's what we're doing. We're just kind of building our information as we go along here. And we'll see some more added to what we know here this morning in chapter 7 of the book of Daniel. So if you got your Bible, let's take a gander there. Chapter 7, Daniel, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar. Now remember where the first year of Belshazzar is the first year of his reign. He is probably like the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. There was a few guys who reigned after Nebuchadnezzar here, and they didn't last very long, different things going on. And then this guy kind of took over, and he made his son, Belshazzar, a co-regent with him. So in the first year of Belshazzar would be here, about 553. Last week we saw the end of his reign here in 539. So we've backed down the timeline for this event here in chapter 7. So chapter 7 actually takes place before what we saw last week. So we're right about here when this particular vision is going to take place, okay? About 553. Now the first one we saw earlier from Nebuchadnezzar would have been back in here somewhere. So we're about, 50 years later, maybe something like that, from the first one we saw in chapter 2. So let's see what this one is all about. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel saw a dream. Remember, the first one was Nebuchadnezzar's dream. This one is Daniel's dream. And in his mind as he lay on his bed, and he wrote the dream down and related it to the following summary of it. So about, let's say, 50 years after Nebuchadnezzar's dream, Daniel, a different person, has a different dream. But he made notes. He wrote it down. And here's what the dream was about. Daniel said, I was looking in my vision by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. Now, these concepts are typically representative of certain things. The concept of a wind is usually representing some sort of a force at work. And it's usually spoken of as four, the four winds, sometimes the four winds of the earth. Well, how does a globe have four corners so that you can say you got a wind from each of the corners? So it's a little bit of a strain to kind of place exactly what that means, but usually it just means forces coming from all directions, north, south, east, and west. So in this dream, he sees these four winds of heaven. These appear to be heavenly driven forces at work. And it was stirring up the great sea. Now, the sea is oftentimes used in Scripture of Gentile peoples. The land is used to represent usually Israel. So the land, Israel, Jews, and the sea, Gentiles, is typically how this symbology is used in work. But we're just guessing so far. We're going to be told the answer here in just a little bit, but that would be the first idea that comes to mind. And in this vision, animals are the player. Remember the one in chapter 2? It was a statue segmented by four different segments, each made of a different metal. So we have different metals in chapter 2. Here we're going to have different animals. Four beasts were coming up from the sea, different from one another. Now, if the sea represents Gentiles, as it usually does, these four animals would be four different types of Gentile representations. Gentile nations, similar to what we saw there in chapter 2. Remember that? We don't know that yet. We're still guessing. We'll get the answer here in a little bit. And these four animals are like, the first one was like a lion and had wings of an eagle. And I kept looking until its wings were plucked, and it was lifted up from the ground and made to stand on 2 feet like a man. A human mind was also given to it. It just happens to be that the symbol of Babylon is a winged lion. So that may be related to this, huh? We'll keep that in mind as we look for the interpretation. But notice that it became a representation of human leadership. A human mind was given to it. Remember back in chapter 4, we saw Nebuchadnezzar take a little visit to the zoo, and he was given an animal's mind. He went from being a human to an animal in his mental capacity. So this one's kind of a reverse of that. And behold, another beast, a second one resembling a bear, and was raised up on one side, and three ribs were in its mouth between its teeth. And thus they said to it, "Arise, devour much meat." Now this bear seems to be, whoever or whatever it represents, it seems to represent something that is not balanced. One side of the bear is more impressive, more powerful, stronger than the other side of the bear. So this relationship, this animal, looks like it represents some kind of an entity that is stronger in part than in the other part. Remember in chapter 2, we saw the second segment of the statue was a Medo-Persian empire, didn't we? Were they equal? No. The Persians were quite a bit stronger than the Medes. So could this be something similar to that? And these three ribs, could it be Lydia, Egypt, and Babylon, the countries that the Medo-Persian Empire destroyed? Maybe. We'll keep that in mind as well. After this, I kept looking, and behold, another one like a leopard, which had on its back four wings of a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. So this third animal looks like it's pretty doggone swift, doesn't it? A leopard that has wings and four heads. Now back in chapter 2, that third entity we saw there was Greece, wasn't it? We were told that back there. Wonder if the number of four leaders of anything would have anything to do with Greece. Remember anything about Greek history? What happened to Alexander when he died at the ripe old age of 33? What happened to the Greek Empire? He was divided up among his four generals, wasn't it? So that's an interesting parallel. Maybe there's something to that. We'll keep that in mind as well as we go forward. And after this, now after those three beasts that we're guessing maybe represents the same three nations, national world empires that we saw earlier, maybe he sees a fourth. After this, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrifying and extremely strong, and it had large iron teeth. Well, again, reverting back to that previous dream in chapter 2, what was the fourth segment of the statue made of? It's iron. Wasn't it? So here comes this metal appearing again in this vision. Iron, but iron teeth. I think they used to make false teeth out of wood. I never heard of them making it out of iron. But this one has got iron teeth, and it devoured and crushed and trampled down the remainder with its feet. And it was different from all the other beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. Well, now, wait a minute. Earlier, the iron entity we saw from the statue also had 10 associated with it, didn't it? 10 toes of clay. Clay doesn't adhere to iron very well. It's not a strong union of any kind. Sometimes unions are formed out of necessity, aren't they? And they're not that strong, but they're formed because they need to be, they have to be. But this time, this beast had 10 horns. Horns are typically representative in Scripture of kings or kingdoms, leadership. So the 10 toes we saw in chapter 2, it looks like perhaps is represented in this vision by 10 horns. So we were thinking that the toes in chapter 10 maybe represent some sort of 10-nation federation that came from the old Roman Empire. Here, this beast he sees has 10 horns. Sounds like it's very, very similar, wasn't it? But check this out. This we did not see in chapter 2. While I was contemplating the horns, behold, another horn, a little one, came up among them. So of the 10 horns, I'm not certain if this is one of the 10 or if it's an additional one, which would be an 11th one. The interpretation here is hard to tell exactly what's happening here. Let's say it's one of the 10, but it could be an 11th that rises up with it. One of them came up amongst them, and three of the first horns were pulled out by the roots before it. Wow. So whatever this 10-horned entity is, one of the 10 rises up above the others and rips three others out by the roots. Takes them over, destroys them, does something to them. That we did not see in chapter 2. This is new information. And that horn, the one that rips out the other three, possessed eyes like the eyes of a man and a mouth uttering great boasts. This sounds like it's representative of some kind of a guy, some kind of a leader, a political leader of sorts, who is boastful and powerful. And he overthrows and takes over three of the others. So, we're seeing a number of similarities here in chapter 7 to the vision we saw in chapter 2, but we're seeing more things added here in 7 that we didn't see in 2. It's looking more and more like some sort of a 10-nation federation will be reformed from the old Roman Empire, and one of those 10 guys will rise to the top of that collection of 10 and uproot or destroy or take over three others as he goes. And he is clearly some sort of a dictator-like guy. He's uttering great boasts. Now, we thought maybe in chapter 2, and we're thinking maybe here as well, that this 10-nation entity, whatever it is exactly, is associated with the old Roman Empire, isn't it? Remember, the 10 toes in chapter 2 was for part of the iron segment of the statue, which was Rome. So what looked like there was some sort of a reformation of these old Roman Empire nations here into some kind of a 10-nation federation. Chapter 7 seems to embellish that same idea, doesn't it? Except that one of these 10 will be more powerful than any of the others and will uproot three of them in the process. Now, if this boundary shows you the old Roman Empire countries, and I don't think we have to necessarily interpret to say, well, that's exactly the boundaries of this new 10-nation federation. That's maybe pressing things too far. But the 10-nation federation will come from somewhere within those boundaries. It will be those old Roman countries. That's what we think we're seeing in these visions so far, okay? So somehow amongst those nations right there, it looks like this 10-nation thing is going to form. And one guy of those 10, whoever he is, will clearly dominate everybody else and literally uproot 3 of the other nations or entities. And I kept looking until thrones were set up. Wow. What's that kind of conjure up in your mind? Thrones. Maybe a scene of judgment. God sits on a throne, doesn't he? God is the judge of this planet. Kind of strikes me as maybe some sort of a judge overseeing this. And the Ancient of Days took his seat. Who's that? Who is the Ancient of Days? That's usually a reference to God the Father, isn't it? And his vesture was like white snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His throne was ablaze with flames. These are all symbols of judgment. So whatever's happening here looks to me like it's some form of judgment that is now being focused on in association with this vision of these animals. And its wheels were a burning fire. And if you can go figure out Ezekiel chapter 1, you know exactly what he's talking about here. But if you would explain it to me before you know exactly what it is, because I can't figure that chapter out. But somehow or another, it's a picture of God's presence, and it is a scene of judgment, as it appears to be here. A river of fire was flowing and coming out from before him. Thousands upon thousands were attending him, and myriads upon myriads were standing before him. And the court set, and the books were opened. Where do we see books in Scripture? Yeah, Revelation chapter 20, the great white throne judgment. The books play a role there, don't they? The books are used to judge the works of men and show that those works are inadequate to achieve God's righteousness, and therefore those men are condemned to an eternity in conscious torment. Books are books of works. The book, singular, is the book of life in which the names of all of the elect from all ages are written. So on the one hand, the lost of all mankind are judged on the basis of their works and shown to be inadequate. The elect are judged on the basis of their faith, and their name is written in the book of life. So book, elect, books, lost. Here we see a reference to the books again. And I kept looking because of the sound of the boastful words which the horn was speaking. This guy is, if nothing else, he is a braggart. And I kept looking until the beast was slain, and his body was destroyed and given to the burning fire. Whatever this last entity is, it will be destroyed as a result of this judgment. And it will be thrown in the burning fire, the lake of fire. Now, as far as the rest of the beasts, their dominion was taken away, but an extension of life was granted to them for an appointed period of time. Here we see this telescoping effect of this one beast. It looks like they died off, but then they actually sort of were resurrected for a while. They sort of came back to life for a while. One is absorbed by the other, the next one absorbs that one, the next one absorbs that one, and then the last one is the incorporation of all of those beasts, and then it seems to kind of come back for a while. An extension of life was granted to it. So Daniel goes on, verse 13, he says, I kept looking in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, one like a son of man was coming. And he came up to the Ancient of Days and was presented before him. We'll see a scene in Revelation chapter 5, 4 and 5, when we get there later, where God the Father is seen on his throne there, and he calls out to the whole world, who is worthy to come and take this scroll that he has in his hand, that is a listing of judgment on the earth? Who is able to come and take this scroll out of my hand and execute these judgments? How many people answered the call? The Son of God. One person only was qualified to be the judge of this world. That's what we see in Revelation 4 and 5. This sounds very much like it here. The Son of Man came up to the Ancient of Days, and it was given to him, verse 14, dominion, glory, and a kingdom that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which will not pass away, and his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed. So the scene involving these animals and the particular emphasis upon the 10 horns of the last animal ends with their destruction by the Son of God. And his kingdom then transitions into a permanent, everlasting kingdom that is never destroyed. As for me, Daniel, my spirit was distressed within me, and the visions in my mind kept alarming me. This thing bugged the heck out of Daniel. He didn't know what in the world to think of this. Now, he interpreted Nebuchadnezzar's dream about 50 years earlier, but this one, he cannot figure it out. So I approached one of those who were standing by and began asking him the exact meaning of all of this. So he told me and made known to me the interpretation of these things. So here's the interpretation. Looks like perhaps an angelic being there, probably Gabriel, was standing by Daniel and is going to explain to him what this dream meant. Who are these animals? What do these horns represent? How do they come back to existence or life for this period of time? And how are they destroyed in the end? All kinds of questions I'm sure he has. And here are the answers that he's given. Verse 17. These great beasts, which are four in number, are four kings who will arise from the earth. Gentile world powers, four kings. What did we see in chapter 2? Gentile world powers, four of them. Same thing here. Only here the symbology are beasts, not segments of a statue represented by different metals. Different dream, 50 years apart, by different people, but very, very similar. And they will rise up from the earth, but the saints of the highest one will receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever for all ages to come. These Gentile world powers will eventually be destroyed, and God's people will take over the kingdoms of the world that will go on forever. That's his very quick, broad brush summary of what this vision is. But Daniel wanted to know more, so he says in verse 19, I desire to know the exact meaning of the fourth beast, which was different from all the others. Remember this fourth segment of the statue in chapter 2 was different too, didn't it? It had 10 toes. This fourth beast has got all these horns and stuff. He's different from the others. He was different from all the others, exceedingly dreadful with its teeth of iron and its claws of bronze, of which devoured, crushed, and trampled down the remainder with its feet. He actually, in essence, trampled down all of the other kingdoms represented by these beasts. And furthermore, what's the meaning of the 10 horns which were on its head, and the other horn which came up, and before which three of them fell, namely that horn which had eyes and a mouth uttering great boasts and which was larger in appearance than its associates? These horns contain one horn that represents an individual that is a more boastful, bigger mouth guy than any of the others. And I kept looking, and that horn was waging war with the saints, and overpowering them. This last horn that he's talking about here is the enemy of God's people. He's waging war with God's people, the saints, and he's winning. He's overpowering them. He's successful. So this is the enemy of Christ. What would we call the enemy of Christ, I wonder? An anti-Christ? Would that be a good title for this guy? That sounds like maybe this guy is what we might call an anti-Christ, since he is the enemy of Christ. And he was overpowering the saints and conquering them until the Ancient of Days came and judgment was passed in favor of the saints of the Highest One, and the time arrived when the saints took possession of the kingdom. So this guy will be successful for a brief period of time, the Antichrist, but God will ultimately pass judgment on him and crush and destroy him, and God's people will then reign going forward. So what appears to be a successful campaign against God's people is brought to a crushing end by God. So he said, verse 23, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all the other kingdoms, and it will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. This last one will be more impressive in terms of world domination and power than these previous three Gentile world powers. So whatever grows out of these old Roman Empire nations will be more forceful, more impressive, more dominating, more anti-Christ than any of the previous ones were. And as for the ten horns, Out of this kingdom, 10 kings will arise, and another will arise after them, and he will be different from the previous ones and will subdue 3 kings, as we guessed earlier was what he was saying there. He will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One, and he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. Well, this guy is very, very impressive. He will badmouth, verse 25, God. He'll wear down the saints of the Highest One. He will oppose and defeat Christian believers at some point in time. He'll even try to change some international laws, alterate various times, and will be particularly successful and dominant for a period of 3.5 years. Verse 25, times, that's 2, time, 1, that's 3, and half a time, that's a half. So for 3.5 years, this guy, this one horn that rises up amongst these other 10, he will be very, very successful at opposing God's people, God's program, God's plan for this earth. He will be what we might call an antichrist. And for 3.5 years, he will be very, very successful in that role. But, verse 26, the court will sit for judgment. That was the Ancient of Days we saw earlier in those thrones. We were correct in guessing that was some kind of a scene of judgment. And this guy, this Antichrist dominion, will be taken away, annihilated, and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the Highest One. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and all the dominions will serve and obey him. So whatever this activity is on the part of this 10-nation federation that comes out of these old Roman Empire countries, whatever it is, it ends after 3.5 years of successful domination by this guy, and he is destroyed and annihilated, and the saints of the Most High take over and rule the world for there. So it is a temporary picture of success that we're going to see here. Now, and at this point, Daniel's just
He totally freaks. My thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. This explanation... Beg pardon? Oh, I'm hearing things again. This explanation that he got from Gabriel about what all this stuff means in this dream just kind of wipes him out, makes him pale. So what have we seen? Well, we've seen two different visions, two different dreams that seem to have very similar meaning. One was in chapter 2, and one is in chapter 7. They look like they're the same painting, just viewed with a little different perspective or slant. What they both seem to be saying to us is that these Gentile world powers will be four in number. Looks like most of that's history now. But the last one, number four in that group of four, the old Roman Empire, will sort of come back to life in the form of a 10-nation federation of some kind, 10 horns. And amongst that 10 group number, whoever they are, one guy will rise up amongst those 10 and dominate all of them. And he will behave as an anti-Christ person. He opposes God's people. And for 3.5 years especially, and if that screen doesn't fall over backwards, I'm going to be surprised. It's leaning there right now. For 3.5 years, he's very successful. But at the end of that 3.5 years, God will judge him, will crush him, and his son, God's son, will take over the kingdoms of this world. Now, with nothing more than what we know so far, what might we be thinking about or looking for as we get into what we think are the end times? We know that this federation of nations has got to come about at some point in time, doesn't it? Maybe we'll be here to see it, maybe we won't. But if we are, what would we be looking for? Some kind of a federation of old Roman Empire or European countries forming some kind of an entity. Makes sense? Doesn't that make sense that something like that would happen? Would it be primarily, you think, economically driven? Maybe. We got the European common market already, so maybe not. I don't know. It could be some kind of revision to that, so that's possible. Could it be, do you think, military? We got NATO, but could NATO be repackaged, reorganized, rebuilt as a result of current events taking place? We don't know exactly how this thing is going to come about. We're not told. We're told it will come about. So I would be watching for or looking for any formation out of Europe of some sort of a federation of nations, either economically driven, militarily driven, or whatever the case may be, that would be the forerunner of that thing right there, that 10-nation, 10-horned group of which one more guy comes up and dominates. Mr. Putin may be a player. He may be driving the Europeans into some sort of a military alliance, NATO-like in structure, perhaps. I don't know. He's knocking on their door. They don't like him knocking on their door. So maybe he will be a driver in the establishment of that 10-nation federation thing. I don't know. I don't know how it's going to be. But something to watch for anyway, isn't it? Okay. That's chapter 7. Chapter 7 is sort of a chapter 2 redux with a little different perspective, but very, very similar picture to what we saw in chapter 2. Well, fiddle-faddle. Let's go ahead and start chapter 8. I don't think we can get all the way through it because it's kind of extensive, but we'll stick our foot in the door and we'll try to finish it up next week. It's a little lengthy for the time we've got left, but let's go ahead on and look at it. Okay. Yeah.
Do you see chapter 7 as a pre-rapture event?
Yeah, we'll get to the rapture as it relates to this stuff a little later on and talk about when we think these things will happen. Now, the hardest thing to figure out of all of this eschatological stuff is when. We can get pretty close on the what, I think, for most of it, but well, the when is really challenging, but we're going to get into that before we're done. So we haven't said anything yet about where we will be when this formation takes place. I'll tell you the answer, and then I'll show you the answer later on when we get to it. We won't be here. Jerry.
But will there be different countries? See, that's confusing to me with Rome and when we see Germany.
Yes, these 10 horns are 10 different countries. They're the horns represent the leader of 10 different countries. So out of this geography. What's that now?
They're going to be different from the feet. You know, the 10 toes.
Well, the 10 toes and the 10 horns are the same basic thing. They're
same
these 10.
Same countries.
Say,
same countries.
Yeah, 10 different countries.
No, I know 10 different, but will they be the same? Like, where is Germany? They're involved right now.
Well, they're the same as they'll come out of that group right there.
Okay.
So, you know, whatever they are today, the countries will come out of that. It's the old Roman Empire's countries that they dominated and controlled that will form this new group. And as you can see there, Germany's not all in that, are they? You got Spain and France and Greece and some of that Southern Europe, Eastern European stuff. Turkey's even in there. That's what they call Asia. The Romans called that area Asia, what is today Turkey. Italy, some Northern African stuff. I don't know how much they will be involved. But these nations will group together somehow or another and form those 10-nation conglomerate, and one guy will rise up amongst that stuff and dominate that 10-nation federation.
And Great Britain's not in that either.
No, Great Britain's. Well, Romans actually controlled Great Britain up to Hadrian's Wall, about the southern half. That map doesn't show it there, but yeah, they could be part of it too. Now, some people say, well, the United States kind of came from most of those countries, so maybe we're represented by some of those European countries there, and that's our participation in this. I don't know if that's makes any sense or not. It may be that we don't have much participation at all, which is what it really looks like, but that is an explanation that some people try to give. We'll talk more about that, too, as we get along. We got more information to come. We're not done putting meat on these bones yet. These visions are giving us a pretty good broad brush picture, and we're adding detail as we go along. And then we'll talk about the timing of all of this later on too, especially when we get into Revelation. Okay, let's go ahead and start looking at chapter 8. In the third year of the reign of Belshazzar, this would be 2 years after the previous vision there in chapter 7, a vision appeared to me, Daniel, subsequent to the one which had appeared previously. So 2 years after the one we just looked at in chapter 7, he gets another dream. And I looked in the vision, and it came about while I was looking that I was at the citadel of Susa, which was in the province of Elam, and I looked in the vision, and I myself was beside the Ulai Canal. He gives us a little geography here of where he was and all, and it doesn't really matter. This place is about 250 miles east of Babylon, so it's over in Persia or Iran, about 250 miles east of where he was when he had the last one. doesn't really matter. Then I lifted my gaze and looked, and behold, a ram, which had two horns. Well, now we got a new animal introduced here, a ram. But we're seeing this number two again. Remember earlier, in chapter two, the second segment of the statue had two arms. In chapter seven, it was Medo-Persian bear, we think. The two there represented the Medo-Persian Empire. Here, the ram has two associated with it as well, two horns standing in front of the canal. And the two horns were long, but one was longer than the other, with the longer one coming up last. Same sort of description we just saw of Persia in chapter 7 with the bear up on one side. The Medes were not as strong as the Persians. That was a two-fold unit, but the Medes were the greater of the two. The Persians were the greater of the two. So here we're seeing, again, some kind of a two-fold representation of this horn, with one side being greater than the other. And I saw the ram budding westward, northward, and southward, and no other beast could stand before him, nor was there anyone to rescue him from his power, but he did as he pleased and magnified himself. So this ram now is conquering wherever he pleases to go. And nobody could stop him. The Medo-Persian Empire. But while I was observing, behold, a male goat was coming from the west over the surface of the whole earth without touching the ground. And the goat had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Wow, here comes another animal. This ram was doing okay until this goat shows up. And this goat is coming from the west of where this ram was. It's hard to see, I know, but it's the only one of these I got that's any good at all. Here's the Medo-Persian Empire. It's all of this stuff you see here in this pink. Okay? All of this. Now, in this vision, what he sees next, and I can't hardly see this, and I'm standing right here on top of it. What is west of the Medo-Persian Empire? What's that area right there? That's Greece, isn't it? Medo-Persian Empire and the Greeks are right there to the west of this. So this goat that comes flying across the ground, coming from the west, he's moving so fast that he's not even touching the ground. And he had a conspicuous horn between his eyes. Did Greece have any kind of a conspicuous leader? Yeah, little Alex. Alexander the Great. His father was Philip of Macedon. He built Philippi and that part of Macedonia. Alexander, by the time he was 33 years of age, had conquered the Medo-Persian Empire and everybody else on the planet that he could get to. He was a conspicuous young man, wasn't he? Maybe this is a picture of Greece. And he came up to the ram that had the two horns, which had been standing in front of the canal, and rushed at him in his mighty wrath. And I saw him come beside the ram, and he was enraged at him. He struck the ram and shattered its two horns, and the ram had no strength to withstand him. So he hurled him to the ground, trampled on him, and there was none to rescue the ram from its power. Then the male goat magnified himself exceedingly, but as soon as he was mighty, the large horn was broken, and in its place came up four conspicuous horns toward the four winds of heaven. So what appears to be the movement of Alexander the Great in the destruction of the Medo-Persian Empire is brought to an end and divided up into four other entities. Does history track that vision in any way? Yeah. What happened to Alexander's empire when he died at the ripe old age of 33 from a combination of alcoholism and some other things that weren't all that pleasant? What happened to the Greek empire? Divided up among his four generals. Four guys that he grew up with took the empire after him. Their names are Ptolemy. He took over Egypt and parts of Asia Minor. Cassander took over Macedonia and Greece. Lysimachus took over Thrace and parts of Asia Minor. And Seleucus took over Syria, Israel, and Mesopotamia. Four different generals divided up the Greek Empire into four different regions, and those four guys took it over. Ptolemy was given Egypt. Who is the last Ptolemite to rule in Egypt? She was the last one to rule in Egypt. Cleopatra. She's the last descendant of this general Ptolemy who took over Egypt. She was the last one of his line of descent. So Cleopatra was the last Ptolemite. She ain't got anything to do with what we're talking about here in Daniel, but it's just an interesting factoid that you can have there. So it looks like this dream, and by the way, the language beginning in chapter 8 is going back to Hebrew, because this relates to Israel's history, not to Gentile world history. The Aramaic we saw through chapter 7 is now over, and everything is in Greek, everything is in Hebrew going forward. So it looks like it is a picture of Greece's domination of the Medo-Persian Empire, just like chapter 2 told us would happen, and chapter 7 told us would happen. These Gentile world empires would be defeated by their successor. So that looks like the picture we're seeing here. And out of one of these four, verse 9, came forth a rather small horn, which grew exceedingly great toward the south, toward the east, and toward the beautiful land, that is, would be toward Palestine. So he's now referring to one of these descendants from Alexander's four generals, in particular, who dominated the south, which would include Israel. And it grew up to the host of heaven and caused some of the hosts and some of the stars to fall to the earth, and it trampled them down. Looks like Israel's leaders, God's people, and their leaders are defeated by this guy. And it even magnified itself to be equal with the commander of the host. That's God. And it removed the regular sacrifice from him, and the place of his sanctuary was thrown down. If you have an Apocrypha, if you got a Catholic Bible, it's in your Bible. If you don't have and can get your hands on an Apocrypha, read the book of 1 Maccabees, and you will get this history of what's being talked about right here. 1 Maccabees chapter 1 talks about this king. He is a king of Syria. He is a Seleucid. He is one of the descendants of Seleucid, one of Alexander's four generals, who reigned over Syria. And he reigned from about 175 BC down to about 168. His name is Antiochus Epiphanes. Epiphanes means he had this unveiling, this epiphany. His real name is just Antiochus, so he adds that to his name to add glamour to his name. But if you read the history of Antiochus Epiphanes, a Syrian king, a Seleucid descendant, he behaved in such a way as to foreshadow for us that Antichrist guy we saw behaving in chapter 7. He isn't the fulfillment of the Antichrist guy, because remember, he's destroyed by the coming back of Christ. He's the stone that crushes the vision in chapter 2 on its feet, Christ is. But he is a prototype of the Antichrist. He behaved just like him. He foreshadows for us, historically, what the Antichrist character of chapter 7 will behave like. Antiochus Epiphanes, a historical king of Syria, 175 to about 168 B.C. That's the guy that's being described here initially, who is foreshadowing the guy who ultimately will fulfill that prophecy, who is the Antichrist. Verse 12, on account of transgressions, the host will be given over to the horn along with the regular sacrifice, that is, God's people, the Jewish people, will be defeated by him. He will change their form of worship in the temple in that time frame, 175 to 168, and it will fling truth to the ground and perform its will and prosper. Then I heard a holy one speaking, and another holy one said to that particular one who was speaking, how long will the visions about this regular sacrifice apply while the transgression causes horror so as to allow both the holy place and a host to be trampled? And he said to me, for 2,300 evenings and mornings, then the holy place will be properly restored. That's the span of the career of Antiochus Epiphanes. From 171 to 164 B.C., 6.38 years or 2,300 mornings and evenings. That's how long he will be around and be successful at this Antichrist-like behavior, foreshadowing the ultimate behavior. Now, we don't have the interpretation yet. We'll save that for next week. But what it looks like so far is that this is a further embellishment of what we saw in chapters 2 and 7. And more detail is being given to us about this one player, this one character, this horn of chapter 7. But it's essentially the same basic things. The ram represents the Medo-Persian Empire, which is one of the four, and the little goat, or the goat, represents Greece. And from Greece comes this one player who is particularly interesting to us because he typifies for us that horn that was raised up in chapter 7 and who dominated all of the other nations of that 10-nation federation, and warred against God's people. So you see what we're getting here now? We're getting this guy defined for us more and more clearly all along. And God has given us a sneak preview of that horn of chapter 7 in the form of this Antiochus Epiphanes, this Syrian king who flows down from the Greek Empire and dominated the Jewish people, trampled them down, disrupted their Jewish worship, defeated them, beat them up pretty good for about 6 or 7 years, until finally he was thrown off of them by the Maccabean Revolution. Judas Maccabeus and the guys finally got rid of this guy. That's why you can go read the account of this in 1 Maccabees if you have an Apocrypha and can get to that book. All right, you follow what we've seen so far? Three visions. They paint the similar picture, but they add a little more definition as we go along. Chapter 7 added a little more to chapter 2, and chapter 8 is adding more to chapter 7. So we're getting a real clear picture so far of what's going to happen at some point in the future. A federation of 10 nations will form from the old Roman Empire. One of those 10 will rise up and defeat the others, and this guy will be, in effect, the Antichrist and will behave like Antiochus Epiphanes behaved historically. That's the three visions we've seen so far here in the book of Daniel. Has any of that happened yet in your lifetime? No, it hasn't happened yet. That's still future stuff, isn't it? How far in the future is that stuff? I don't know. A couple days? A couple weeks? A couple months, maybe? No, it's still to come, and we don't know when it will all begin. But we know enough about the details to think that it has to be very, very close. Don't we? And we're not done. There's more information to hang on this structure than what we've seen so far. But do you understand what we have seen so far? Any questions about that? The key player will be a guy who goes by 30 different titles. You want me to read all 30 of them to you? You probably don't. But let me read just a few of them that are the more well-known ones. He's known as the little horn here in Daniel 7. He's the prince that shall come. We'll see him in chapter 9. He's the Antichrist. John calls him that in John chapter 2. He's the beast of Revelation 11. The king of fierce countenance in Daniel 8, we'll see here. And the Lord called him the abomination of desolation in Matthew 24. But there's 30 different names used for this guy. And Antiochus Epiphanes is a foreshadowing of all of those 30 different names, because those names apply to the final Antichrist, and he is the foreshadowing, the stereotype of him. You cool so far?
Yeah, we got it all.
What's that, Jerry?
I said we've got it all.
Got it all down? Okay, good.
But will the Antichrist have to be over a nation, or could he be a character like a George Soros?
No, I think he will rise up among the ten horns, remember? He is one of the horns, and he uproots the other. So he will be a leader of one of those ten nations that is in that ten-nation federation.
And Russia is in that.
I beg your pardon?
Russia?
No, Russia's not in that.
So Putin can't be?
Well, he can drive world geopolitics to the point where that ten-nation federation will form, perhaps to compete with him, like a NATO-type alliance, for example. So he may be a player in driving the origination of that 10-nation federation, but he will not be a member of it.
And so people at one time thought like Hitler would have been, but he couldn't have either because he's not in his 10 nations.
No, and he's dead and gone.
But I'm saying back then.
Yeah. No, he couldn't have been. Well, depends on the boundaries of Germany, whether they were in there or not. You'd have to know carefully when and where Germany was in the Roman Empire. Part of it was, part of the time. So that'd be a hard one to define for sure. Questions, comments?
Chapter 8 then deals with the Jewish people.
Beg your pardon?
Could you make the comment in chapter 8 dealing with the Jewish people?
Yeah, chapter 8 begins a history of the Jewish people. Up to the beginning of chapter 8, we've got Gentile world history. Now we're picking up in chapter 8 and going forward, Jewish world history, and Antiochus Epiphanes was a big player in their history because he dominated them and abused them and persecuted them and tried to destroy them as best he could. The Maccabean Revolution, Judas Maccabeus and his sons led that revolt and cleansed the temple and got rid of him. The Jewish people added a feast to celebrate that. Remember what that is? That's Hanukkah. The Feast of Light is the celebration of the cleansing of the temple from Antiochus Epiphanes, throwing him out and reestablishing proper Jewish worship there. That's their celebration of that event, Hanukkah. It was not one of the original six that God instituted in the book of Leviticus, but they added that one along with Feast of Purim, so they added two during the intertestament period. Okay, we got more to go. We'll review all this and keep hammering it until it settles in, but we'll have to let you go here this morning. We're out of time, so see you next Thursday, Lord willing. Have a good week.